Have you ever had that terrible feeling where you just feel completely awful, right? Like you go to the doctor, you run a whole battery of tests.
Right, they do all the blood work, the scans, everything.
Yeah, exactly. All of it. And then they come back, sit down, and say, "Great news. All your numbers are perfectly normal."
Meanwhile, you can barely, get out of bed.
You feel like garbage. Your joints ache. Your brain is just, it's full of fog. You have zero energy. But your doctor is basically looking at you like, "Well, I don't know what to tell you." Or maybe you have an older relative who is managing like eight different chronic
Oh,
diseases.
yeah, taking 15 different pills a day.
Yes, 15 pills. And they're seeing five different specialists, but no single doctor seems to be looking at the whole person.
It's just incredibly fragmented, and it's a huge source of frustration for so many people.
It really is. So, okay, let's unpack this. Today, our mission is to dive into a really fascinating, honestly groundbreaking 2026 academic white paper. It's by Dr. Bechara Saheeli, and it's called Life Coherent Internal Medicine.
And it attempts to solve exactly this paradox, the fundamental paradox of modern medicine.
Right, because we have this extraordinary technology today, right? We can diagnose disease down to the genetic level. We can prolong life. We can stop a heart attack in its tracks.
We can replace a shattered hip with titanium. We can cure hepatitis C with, just a short course of antivirals.
Exactly. The science is basically magic at this point.
Yeah.
But the actual living, breathing coherence of the patient just kind of it disappears.
It completely vanishes into these fragmented disease codes and totally disconnected subspecialties. And I think we need to set the tone here because Dr. Saheeli's paper, it's not an attack on scientific medicine.
Right. He's not saying throw away the MRI machines.
Not at all. It explicitly praises the life-saving heights of modern pharmacology and critical care. But it's a search for what he calls a deeper clinical grammar, a framework to restore the actual human being to the center of the medical equation.
Okay, so before we can understand the solution, we really need to clearly define the problem. Like, why do medical students memorize literally thousands of facts, but then sometimes totally fail to see the patient sitting right in front of them?
Well, it starts with how we're trained. The paradoxical height of internal medicine is that we have this amazing diagnostic precision, but it's a pedagogical failure.
What do you mean by pedagogical failure? Like how they're taught?
Exactly. When medical students are trained, they encounter all these different systems as entirely separated territories. They do a rotation in cardiology, then they jump to pulmonology, then nephrology.
So it's like, okay, today we're doing the heart. Forget the lungs, just look at the heart.
Right. And they're taught to approach symptoms using long, disconnected checklists. The paper uses the examples of dyspnea, which is shortness of breath and fatigue.
Okay, so someone comes in saying, "I'm tired and I can't breathe."
Yeah. And the medical student is trained to pull out a mental checklist. Is it pneumonia? Is it asthma? Is it heart failure or depression? Or maybe anemia?
So they're just running down a list, trying to match the symptom to a specific isolated broken part.
Precisely. They're trying to rule things in or rule them out, which is great for catching emergencies, but it trains the physician to view a symptom merely as a broken component, not as a systemic disturbance.
It's like taking your car to the shop, right? And there's a steering wheel specialist
Right.
and a tire expert and an engine guy.
I love that analogy. Yeah.
But none of them are actually asking if the car drives
Yeah.
or where it's going. The tire guy just says, "Well, the tread is fine, so it's not my problem."
Exactly. And that fragmentation is especially disastrous when we talk about multimorbidity, which is, chronic disease.
Right, having multiple things wrong at once.
Yeah. If a patient has diabetes, hypertension, and kidney disease, they aren't experiencing three separate mechanical breakdowns. They are experiencing a singular conserved pattern of biological and social overload.
Okay, wait, explain that. Singular conserved pattern.
So the current model refracts this patient through multiple lenses. The nephrologist lowers the blood pressure for the kidneys. The rheumatologist gives them an anti-inflammatory for their arthritis.
Which probably messes with the kidneys.
It absolutely spikes the blood pressure and damages the kidneys. And then the psychiatrist prescribes an SSRI for depression, which leads to weight gain, which makes the diabetes worse.
Oh, man, it's just a totally chaotic crossfire of pills.
It is. Each pill is scientifically justified in isolation by that specific mechanic, but collectively they are destroying the patient's overall capacity to live.
So to fix this incredibly fragmented view, we obviously need a new foundational philosophy. We have to move away from that whole machine metaphor we just used with the car.
We do. We have to discard the biological machine metaphor entirely. And the paper anchors this in the work of two revolutionary biologists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela.
Okay, I've heard of them. They did a lot of work in the biology of cognition, right?
Yes, in the 1970s. And the core foundation of Sitihili's paper is their concept of the living unity, or what they call autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis. Okay, let's break that down for the listener. What is that?
So an autopoietic system is one that continuously produces and sustains its own organization. The patient is not an inert object, like a car, to be commanded.
Right, a car is built by an outside force. It doesn't build itself.
Exactly. A factory that makes cars is an allopoietic system. It produces something other than itself. But a living cell, or a human being, is autopoietic. We are constantly breaking down our own cells and rebuilding them to maintain our own living identity.
So we are self-producing unity.
Yes. And because we are autonomous and self-producing, medical interventions like drugs, surgery, even diet, they don't instruct the body, they perturb it.
Okay, perturb, like poking it or disrupting it.
Yeah, introducing a disturbance. You can't type a command into a human like you can a computer. When a doctor prescribes a beta blocker, they're just introducing a perturbation. How the living system responds depends entirely on the organism's own internal structure.
So if I give the exact same blood pressure pill to three different people, the pill doesn't just automatically lower the blood pressure. The body decides what to do with that perturbation.
Exactly. One person stabilizes, another gets extreme fatigue, a third might have a dangerous drop in blood pressure. The drug didn't dictate the outcome, the living organism did.
That makes so much sense. But okay, if illness isn't just a broken part inside the machine, where is the illness?
This brings us to Maturana's second huge concept. Structural coupling.
Structural coupling, okay.
The organism and its medium, its environment, are continuously interacting, and they co-determine structural change in each other. Illness isn't just inside the patient. It literally exists in the relationship between the patient and their environment.
Okay, wait, I got to push back here for a second. Isn't this just like a fancy, highly academic way of describing the biopsychosocial model from the 1970s?
I'm glad you brought that up, because it sounds similar, but it's fundamentally different.
Because, I mean, we've known forever that stress causes ulcers. General Holistic Health has been talking about the mind-body-environment connection for decades.
Right. But what's fascinating here is how the source text distinguishes structural coupling from the biopsychosocial model. Biopsychosocial models tend to operate additively.
Additively, like stacking them on top of each other.
Yes, they just add social factors on top of biology. The doctor treats the real biology with a pill and then refers you to a social worker for your stress.
Ah, I see.
But structural coupling explains how the social literally becomes biological through recurrent perturbations.
How does that actually happen physically?
Think about a patient living in chronic poverty, facing the constant threat of omission. That social reality isn't just emotional context. The brain perceives a chronic threat, which activates the sympathetic nervous system. Cortisol and adrenaline skyrocket.
So the body is physically locked in fight or flight.
Yes. And that elevated blood pressure literally, physically damages the endothelial lining of the blood vessels. The immune system detects that damage and creates chronic inflammation. Over years, that social condition physically builds atherosclerotic plaques in the arteries.
Wow. So the environment isn't just the background context. It is the actual physical medium through which the body gets sick.
Exactly. And this leads to another crucial concept from the paper, clinical distinction.
Right, because if a doctor is only looking at a lab value, they're completely missing that whole eviction, poverty, stress pipeline you just described.
Because a doctor doesn't see pure, objective reality. They only see what they are rigorously trained to distinguish. If a medical curriculum only trains a physician to distinguish pharmacological targets like bad cholesterol, the physician will inevitably miss the toxic structural coupling driving that cholesterol up.
So they're technically treating the symptom, but entirely ignoring the reality of the patient's life.
Right. And so the paper argues that we need a fundamentally new definition of health, because having normal lab numbers clearly isn't enough if your structural coupling is destroying you.
Okay, so if health isn't just normal numbers, what is it? Because doctors are in the ICU treating real emergencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do we translate this high-level philosophical biology into something practical?
Dr. Saley proposes the life coherence criterion. He argues that health is actually life capacity.
Life capacity.
Yes. It is the capacity of a living person to sustain, adapt, repair, regulate, relate, and participate meaningfully in life.
I really love that phrase, participate meaningfully in life.
It changes everything. You can have chronic disease labels, but if you still have the capacity to adapt, to repair your tissues, and engage with your family, you have life capacity. You are healthy in this framework.
And on the flip side, you could have immaculate blood work, but if you can't get out of bed to play with your kids, you are biologically unwell.
Exactly. And to structure this, the paper breaks down 7 primitives of the framework. We've touched on a few: living unity, clinical distinction, and structural coupling.
What are the other 4?
They are life capacity, energy transformation, boundary and exchange, and repair trajectory.
Okay, let's make that real for the listener. What does it look like when those primitives fail?
Let's use a common example. An 82-year-old grandfather goes to the doctor. He has hypertension, high blood pressure.
Pretty standard.
The doctor, following strict biomedical guidelines, sees the high number and prescribes a heavy dose of a beta blocker to force that number down.
And technically, the drug works, right? The blood pressure drops.
A total biomedical win. But let's look at the primitive of life capacity. The drug causes severe orthostatic hypotension. Every time the grandfather stands up, his blood pressure bottoms out and he gets dizzy.
Oh, and for an 82-year-old, getting dizzy means a huge risk of falling and breaking a hip.
Exactly. Plus, the drug limits his heart rate so much that he gets profound crushing fatigue. He stops going to the park. He stops playing with his grandkids. He becomes isolated.
So the doctor fixed the number, but completely destroyed his life capacity.
This is a failure of boundary and exchange. He can't safely interact with his physical environment. It's a failure of energy transformation. But most importantly, it violates the primitive of repair trajectory.
Repair trajectory. I want to dig into that because the paper introduces the concept of salutogenesis here.
Yes, salutogenesis is critical.
Moving beyond just preventing disease, which is pathogenesis, toward actively generating and completing repair.
Exactly. A life coherent intervention has to facilitate the patient's return to tissue integrity and balance. Suppressing a symptom with a beta blocker isn't salutogenesis if it leaves the grandfather in a state of permanent exhaustion.
So it's about proportionality.
Yes. Does this intervention restore viable life capacity with minimum harm, or does it merely manage a number while degrading the human being?
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
Yeah.
Well, if you reframe your health as your capacity for participation and agency, it completely shifts the goalposts of what a successful doctor's visit actually looks like.
It's no longer just getting a report card on your cholesterol.
Right. You're evaluating your actual capacity to live your life. But honestly, how does a busy internist actually use this? They have, what, maybe 15 minutes with a patient?
That is the practical challenge. And Dr. Sakhili addresses this by condensing these primitives into a repeatable 6-step loop to use right at the patient's bedside. It's called the life coherent clinical loop.
Okay, let's walk the listener step by step through this loop. Imagine someone comes into the clinic. What is step one?
Step one is stabilize danger. And this is crucial. The framework absolutely does not abandon acute life-saving biomedicine.
So if I come in having a heart attack, the doctor isn't going to sit down and ask me about my social environment.
Right. They aren't going to map your structural coupling while you're in cardiac arrest. They're going to use every piece of modern technology to save your life because a dead patient has no life capacity.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, so once the acute danger is stabilized, what's step two?
Step two is distinguish the syndrome. Recognizing the clinical patterns. This is standard internal medicine. Okay, you have chest pain or acute kidney injury or elevated glucose.
And this is usually where the traditional doctor stops, right? They make the diagnosis, they write the prescription, and they move to the next room.
Exactly. But the life coherent loop forces them to keep going. Step three is locate capacity failure. Beyond the disease label, what living function can this person no longer sustain?
So instead of just saying you have asthma, asking why has your capacity to oxygenate your tissues failed?
Yes. Which leads seamlessly into step four. Map coupling conditions. This is the big paradigm shift. What pattern of living, the diet, the trauma, the poverty, the medications keeps reproducing this illness?
Let's use an example to make this concrete. Say a 65-year-old woman comes in. She's exhausted. Her blood sugar is creaking up. Her kidneys are a little distressed.
A classic multi-morbid presentation. In step four, the physician maps her environment and discovers she is the sole caregiver for a husband with advanced dementia.
Oh, wow. So she's probably sleeping like 2 hours a night.
If she's lucky. She's living in chronic hypervigilance. She's eating ultra-processed convenience foods because she has no time to cook. Her social environment is an allostatic load that vastly exceeds her biological reserves.
So her environment is literally reproducing the high blood sugar and the kidney distress.
Exactly. Which brings us to step five, perturb wisely. Intervene with the least harm to reopen viability. If you just give her a drug like metformin for her blood sugar, you might cause severe gastrointestinal distress.
Which would just be the final straw for her. It would break her.
Right. So a wise perturbation might actually be coordinating with a social worker to get her respite care so she can sleep for 4 uninterrupted hours.
That's incredible. The prescription is sleep and social support, not just a pill.
And then step 6 is observe repair trajectory. Did the intervention work? Did her life capacity return? Did she regain her energy? Or did the intervention just shift the burden to another organ system?
This loop completely flips the script. It protects the rigor of conventional internal medicine while giving it a deeper purpose. It really turns the physician from a mechanic fixing parts into a guide restoring the conditions for life.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it requires a totally different way of visualizing the body's internal workings. If we aren't looking at isolated organs anymore, what are we looking at?
Yeah, how does step 3 locating capacity failure actually work anatomically?
The paper reorganizes physiology from organ systems like lungs, heart, kidneys, into what it calls capacity systems.
Capacity systems. What's an example of that?
So instead of looking just at the lungs, you look at oxygenation. Oxygenation integrates the pulmonary tissue, the vascular network, the hemoglobin, all working together as a functional unit to bring oxygen to the cells.
So it's grouping the body by what it does, not just by the physical part.
Exactly. There's circulation, clearance, defense and tolerance, repair and remodeling, regulation. But the most crucial one for this paper is energy transformation.
Energy transformation.
Yeah.
And this brings us to, honestly, my favorite part of the paper, the mighty mitochondria.
Yes. The paper does a deep dive into the mitochondria, heavily citing the mitoception framework by Liu, Picard, and Wallace.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because everything I learned in high school biology was just the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
Right.
It just takes glucose and makes energy.
We have to completely unlearn that. That passive powerhouse metaphor is dead. Modern biology reveals that mitochondria are the primary environmental stress sensors of the entire cell.
They're sensors. Like they're feeling what's going on outside.
Yes. They are dynamic, shape-shifting computational hubs.
Right.
They literally change their physical shape in response to psychological stress.
Wait, psychological stress? Like if I'm stressed at work, my mitochondria change shape.
Absolutely. If a person is bathed in inflammatory markers from a toxic environment, the mitochondria undergo a process called fission. They fragment into smaller pieces.
How do they do that?
To protect the cell. They intentionally start producing ATP, which is energy, and instead they start producing reactive oxygen species to fight what they perceive as an infection. They shift from energy production to cellular defense.
Wow, so they just shut down the factory to build weapons.
Exactly. And this leads to a massive, crucial clinical distinction in the paper, the difference between an energy deficit and an energy gap.
Yes. Let's spend some time on this because this distinction alone is just so powerful for patients. Let's start with energy deficit. What is that?
An energy deficit is a simple supply chain failure. You are lacking the required physical inputs. You don't have enough oxygen or glucose or iron.
So if I have severe anemia because I don't have enough iron, I'm exhausted. That's a deficit.
Yes. And the traditional biomedical solution works perfectly here. Give the patient iron, supply the missing input, and the fatigue resolves.
But what if I have plenty of iron? What if my oxygen is 99% and my blood sugar is normal?
That is the energy gap. An energy gap occurs when all the inputs are present, but the body's energy demand vastly exceeds the mitochondria's transformation capacity.
Because the mitochondria have fragmented to defend the cell?
Exactly. The mitochondria have sensed a hostile environment. Maybe it's chronic sleep loss, severe social trauma, an unyielding viral infection, and they downregulate energy transformation to protect you from metabolic burnout.
So if someone goes to the doctor and their labs are perfect, no deficit, but they have an energy gap, what happens in the traditional model?
Traditional medicine often dismisses them. The doctor sees normal labs and concludes there is no biological basis for the profound exhaustion. The patient gets labeled as anxious or depressed or just unmotivated.
They're told it's all in their head, which is just massive moral injury for the patient. They know they're physically sick.
It is medical gaslighting. But the concept of the energy gap validates their physical reality. It proves that the exhaustion is real at a subcellular level. We were just measuring the wrong thing. We measured the supply of fuel, but the pathology is the collapse of the transformation capacity.
I mean, that shifts the whole conversation. The doctor shouldn't ask, are you actually sick? They should be asking, what in your environment is forcing your mitochondria into defense mode?
Yes. But the source text explicitly warns against what it calls mitochondrial reductionism.
What does that mean? Just blaming everything on mitochondria?
Right. Mitochondria aren't the magical, isolated root cause of all disease. And you can't cure an energy gap just by buying an expensive mitochondrial supplement online.
Oh, right, because the supplement doesn't change your toxic work environment or your sleep deprivation.
Exactly. Mitochondria are mediators. They are where your physical resources and your environmental stress collide. You protect the mitochondria by removing the toxic perturbations in your life.
Theory is fascinating, but let's see how a doctor actually uses this in a real clinic. Let's look at how this changes the treatment of three really common issues: fatigue, dyspnea, and frailty. Let's start with fatigue.
So with fatigue, as we just discussed, you move past the checklist of diseases. You don't just check the thyroid and the iron. You ask, what is conserving this fatigue? Is it shift work? Is it unresolved grief? Is it chronic pain or social isolation?
You're mapping the coupling conditions.
Exactly. And for dyspnea's shortness of breath, it's a similar reframing. It's not just a lung or heart issue. The paper describes it as a failure of threat physiology and energy transformation.
Threat physiology.
Yeah.
Because when you can't breathe, your brain immediately panics.
Yes. The amygdala fires, the sympathetic nervous system kicks in, and you get severe anxiety and rapid heart rate. So if you have an asthma patient, the airway inflammation might be triggered by air pollution.
Or mold in their apartment.
Right. But it's massively worsened by the sheer psychological terror of, say, not being able to afford their inhaler.
Right. So if the doctor just gives them an inhaler, they're only fixing half the problem.
A life-coherent physician uses the inhaler to stabilize the acute danger, but recognizes that the structural coupling, the mold, the financial terror is the primary driver. True salutogenesis requires addressing that environment.
Okay, that makes sense. But I want to apply the wise perturbation concept to frailty. Because frailty is so complex, how do you treat an 85-year-old patient who has basically no adaptive reserve left?
Frailty is the ultimate test of this framework. The paper references the Fried phenotype of frailty.
What's that?
It's a clinical classification. It includes unintentional weight loss, self-reported exhaustion, profound weakness, and very slow walking speed.
So it's not just getting old?
No, it's a systemic warning that the patient's adaptive reserve is gone. They're in a state of homeostasis, meaning the physiological window where they can maintain balance is razor thin.
So they might look okay sitting in the chair, but one tiny push, a new medication, a minor cold, and they just collapse.
Precisely. A healthy adult observes a minor urinary tract infection easily. In a frail patient, that same infection causes delirium, which leads to a fall, a broken hip, hospitalization, and often death.
So how do you perturb wisely when any perturbation could be dangerous?
You realize that standard best practice guidelines might actually be harmful. If the guideline says a diabetic needs a blood sugar under 7.0, pushing a frail 85-year-old's blood sugar that low with aggressive insulin is incredibly dangerous. It risks severe hypoglycemia.
So you just stop treating the disease markers.
The goal shifts from maximizing disease treatment to protecting whatever vital reserve remains.
Yeah.
You aggressively strew away medication burden, a process called deprescribing.
You take away the pills that are just managing numbers but causing side effects.
Exactly. You focus on restoring sleep, ensuring basic nutrition, and setting functional goals that actually matter to the patient. Can they walk to the bathroom safely? Do they recognize their family? That is the pinnacle of life capacity and frailty.
This brings us to a really radical realization. I mean, if our health, our biology, our mitochondria are completely dependent on structural coupling, our ongoing interaction with our environment, then things like housing and food and public trust, they aren't just political issues.
No, they are literal biological inputs. And the paper introduces this concept as the civil commons.
The civil commons. I love this idea. It's the shared life support systems of humanity, right? Clean water, nourishing food, safe housing, meaningful work.
Yes. And the paper states very clearly, when the civil commons fails, Bodies absorb the consequences.
Chronic disease becomes the biological ledger of social incoherence. That quote just hits so hard.
It's a profound statement. It means that widespread metabolic syndrome or asthma in a community isn't just an aggregate of poor individual lifestyle choices. It is the physical, biological record of a degraded environment.
This raises such an important question about public health, doesn't it? The World Health Organization talks all the time about the social determinants of health.
Right, but historically, medicine treats those as just external risk factors. Sahili's framework fully realizes them as biological mechanisms. Poverty, pollution, institutional neglect, they are life conditions that literally shape our mitochondrial capacity and our immune tolerance.
It's undeniable.
Yeah.
But I know some people will push back and say, doctors shouldn't be activists, this is just politicizing medicine. But the author explicitly notes this isn't about politics, does he?
He does. He says this is an undeniable fidelity to the living conditions of health. If you are an expert in human physiology, you cannot ignore the physical realities that are dismantling that physiology. To do so is scientifically negligent.
So what is the doctor supposed to do? The paper says the life-coherent internist actually has three roles.
Yes. The first is the clinician. They must use their biomedical training to treat acute disease and stabilize danger.
Right, fix the immediate problem.
The second is the healer. They navigate the clinical loop, restore capacity, and perturb wisely to generate repair.
And the third role?
The third is the witness. The physician must identify and document recurring patterns of life harm that exceed the individual patient. If 50 patients from the same neighborhood all have the same toxic exposure driving their mitochondria into failure, the physician must bear witness to the collapse of the civil commons in that community.
They have to speak the truth about the environment. That is just, it's a massive, beautiful shift from viewing patients as broken machines.
Mm-hmm.
We are living unities structurally coupled to our world.
And our medicine needs to reflect that reality.
Okay, to wrap up this deep dive, let's summarize the core takeaways for you, the listener. You are a living unity. Health is your life capacity to participate meaningfully in the world. And true healing requires addressing not just your lab results, but your energy gaps and your environment.
It requires protecting the conditions under which you can naturally repair and thrive.
Absolutely. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. It builds directly on the paper's concept of observer-dependent distinction making.
Right. The idea that doctors only see what they are trained to distinguish.
Exactly. If doctors are limited by the clinical distinctions they are taught to make, what about us? What about you?
That's a fascinating question.
How does the vocabulary you use to describe your own health, your stress, and your identity restrict or expand your capacity to heal? Think about it. When you're exhausted, do you make the clinical distinction that you're just lazy or broken?
Or do you recognize that you are a living unity responding intelligently to a massive energy gap?
Exactly. Are you treating yourself like a broken machine, or are you actively nurturing your own conditions for life? The words you use to define your reality might be the most powerful biological perturbation of all. It's definitely something to think about before your next trip to the doctor.
It really is.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.